You're just fine, Peter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's me. All right. Some things never change.
I want to welcome everyone to our Tuesday night Cash Flow Depot coaching call. Tonight, Peter Fortunato from Tampa, Florida, is my guest speaker, and he's going to talk about options. They're such a powerful tool with so many different uses, short-term options, long-term options, and Peter's going to talk a little bit about why it's such a good strategy for you to include in your real estate toolbox right now. So, Peter, let's get started with just a little introduction about yourself for the benefit of those people on the call that don't know who you are. So give us a little bit of a background, and then we'll get started with talking about options.
Okay, Jackie. Well, I think most of the people at Cash Flow Depot probably know who I am. But my name is Pete Fortunato. Before I was in real estate, I was in high school, and that was in 1965. So I've been doing this for a long, long, long time. And I began as a real estate agent trying to make a living and acquire enough property and enough assets so that I could be comfortably unemployed. It took me a decade to get to that point that I had enough assets and I didn't have to go to work every day. I could stay home and interfere in the lives of my children. That's one of my very favorite things. Now, of course, the kids are in their middle 30s and I'm still interfering. But in any case, I began in real estate in 1965. It took me 10 years to have enough real estate and control enough rents so that I could really stay home and enjoy myself. Since that time, I've structured transactions and been involved in transactions for myself, my family, my friends, my clients, and just people I bump into on the street who I can't help but interfere in their lives too. And I get a wonderful, wonderful thrill out of every transaction that I'm able to structure, and I just love doing it. And when we're talking about options, where I wanted to start is just with a warning that if you become structure-focused and technique-focused, you will fail to close transactions that you could otherwise have closed. Way, way, way back when I was taking classes from many, many different teachers, one of the great impacts on my life was Warren Harding showing us so very clearly that all opportunities are born of uncomfortable circumstances of people, and it's in resolving or helping them to resolve those uncomfortable circumstances that we were able to successfully close transactions. And so one of the big lessons of that is if I try to force the same deal on everybody or the same technique on every opportunity or every problem that I was faced with, too many times I'd fail, not because I couldn't have come up with a way to do it, but because I was too focused on using a technique that I was enamored of. And so I caution people, because I know we're talking just about options here today, but we're not really talking about options. We're talking about situations and people and the fact that options are very often a tool that can be used to really create some benefits or construct some benefits and distribute those benefits to specific people. I've used options so many times over the years, and many, many, many times they've worked just as I hoped. Now, sometimes the last 7 or 8 years, for example, the market has betrayed me, and my options to buy a property that would look like a fantastic price in 2006 didn't look like such a good price in 2011. And so you got to remember that when you're structuring a transaction, you're also reading markets, reading your own personal life and what's going on. And while I've had some wins, we've also had some losses. And it's been a fascinating and a very, very enjoyable life for me, my real estate life. So do you want to just go on and jump in, or do you want to got some questions to ask?
Just go ahead and jump
All right.
in. And you know,
All right.
Just jump right in.
Okay, the biggest question I get with options, the one of my concerns with the office, I get a call from people and they say, I've been working like crazy in multiple listings and I can't find anyone to give me an option. Well, in the first case, probably no one's going to give you an option. They're probably going to trade you an option for some benefit that they like better than the option they've given up. But when you're looking in multiple listings, that's the wrong place to look for options, because the people who have their houses listed in multiple listings are sellers. People value options because they want to use the property. Now, for many of them, they want to use it to live in or to run their business from, but others who are managers want to use them to generate income. But people who want to use the property will give up an option to get that property or to enable them to keep that property. People who are in multiple listing want to sell that property. They want to be rid of it. And so they're really a bad bet. That's a bad place to search for an option. So in the event you're dealing with a seller and you are in a multiple listing type of a situation, or just talking to someone who's moving from an area, or their family has totally outgrown a property and they're not an investor and would not like to keep the property as a rental, you then many times, if the option is something that will work, it'll work only when you add it to a lease, and the lease lets you take the burdens of the operation of the property off their back. With that lease, you may find the lease option will work fine for a seller, but one of the people, or many of the people who call me, are really looking for an option, and they're looking in the wrong place because they're looking at sellers. Sellers want to be rid of the property, leave it behind them. And the options I've had, the pure options that did not involve a lease, have been with people who wanted to live in that house. Either people we enable to stay in that house or people we enable to afford to stay in that house or people we enable to acquire the house so they could be in there in the first place. The next thing is the option is simply a right to acquire or to sell something, to buy or to sell it. And for our purposes as an investor, I'm looking at it as a right to buy something. I will look at them in two different ways. Primarily for me, an option is something I use as an investment. And it's something I use to structure the control of a property for many years. I'm going to say the average period of time for an option that I would do is 10 years. One of the questions that I see a lot is that people try to get, they ask about long or short-term options and how it's negotiated. And I'm going to tell you, with an investment option, because the person that you're negotiating with typically does want to use the house, the term of that option is going to have a lot to do with their lifestyle. And one of the most common reasons for a period of time for an option is the school careers that are planned for their children. And very often I'll negotiate an option that can't be exercised for the first 5 years or 7 years. Or I did a transaction 2 years ago with a young man with three children. The youngest of them was two. And so with the two-year-old, we had to make sure she could stay in the house where we were making the deal until she got out of elementary school so she could live near her grandparents and her great-grandmother. And so that option could not be exercised before 12 years, but could be any time thereafter up until 20 years. And so a period of time when the people can stay and you won't take the house away from them, they'll be protected in the use of the house, has been a very key part of our investment options. Now, there's another kind of option and something I've used much, much less because I'm much less of a businessman than I am an investor. And that's a tactical option where I go to somebody who's got a house that I'm convinced that I could sell for $100,000. And I give them a contract that is $100,000 price, $1,000 down for the option. And it's a contingent contract that says it's contingent upon my selling it to someone else and assigning it. And it has a sole liquidated damages clause that says if I'm unsuccessful in reselling it, I've lost $1,000 and, of course, my time and my energy and trying to put a deal together. But in that case, it's not an investment where I'm trying to acquire and control the benefits of that particular property over a long period of time. It's a case of I'm trying to just buy the property or I'm trying to control the property so that I can sell it and make a profit, just pure income. In that case, it's a relatively simple approach to someone who actually does want to sell and get rid of the property. And I say, I'll bet you $1,000 that I can get this house sold and get you that much money for the property within this period of time. That contract, that tactical contract to buy it and sell it, is a very different kind of options than the 100 plus that I've done most of my life. And those tactical options, I've probably done fewer than five in my whole life. I have, however, had my IRA fund a few of those for guys who are in the buy-sell business. And my IRA has lent them some of the money so that they can put some money up as option consideration on tactical options where they were buying and selling. Now, again, I want to go back to users are the ones who typically give you or trade you an investment option that lets you have the property for some significant period of time. Now, that being said, let's talk about a comparison, and an interesting comparison, I think. Several years ago, one of our friends came to see us, and he was doing an exchange, which I helped him structure. And as a result of the exchange, he was getting a less expensive house for a more expensive house. The less expensive house was going to take him $10,000 plus the property he was trading away and an additional $10,000 to control a $60,000 house. So he needed $20,000 in cash. He came to see me, and he came to see a very, very good friend of mine who's a hard money lender. And he approached me, and he explained the situation. And I said, well, gee, Steve, I'll put up $20,000 for the right to buy half of this property for $30,000. My $20,000 will apply. So for me to exercise my option, I'd have to put another $10,000 with the $20,000 I'm giving you and buy half of a $60,000 property for $30,000. The hard money lender said, Steve, I'll lend you $20,000 at 15%, and it will cost you $250 a month, and I'll make it a three-year hard money loan. So now Steve was in that situation where he could sacrifice cash flow and keep all the growth for himself, or he could sacrifice growth and have a much more comfortable cash flow to be a great rental house. And so after some talk, he decided that he'd rather have the cash flow and keep the house long term. So he sold me an option to buy half the house for $30,000, and I paid him $20,000, which applied to the price, up front. When I paid him that $20,000 up front, he used that to complete his exchange, acquire the property, shine it up, and get it rented. It was a nice, positive cash flow rental property. Since he had no payments, he had a great cash flow. He was very, very happy. That was in 2004. He planned to hold it long term. In 2007, however, it was clear to him that our market had changed. And he called me. He said, Pete, I know you thought we're going to hold this property long term, but the market's going down. It's hurting. I'm going to take the chance and sell it right now. Would you object if I sold the property for $90,000? $90,000 would mean that we made $30,000 on the $60,000 house that we bought with your $20,000. So when that deal closed, the $90,000 came in, $45,000 went on my side, $45,000 went on Steve's side. My side was reduced by $10,000, which was added to Steve's to pay the other $10,000 I owed him to exercise my option. So Steve got the first $20,000 out, and we split 50-50 above that. Now, there's a couple of lessons there. First of all, if Steve had only been going to hold the property and flip it, he'd have been much better off to have borrowed hard money, because it would have surely cost him $3,000 a year in interest, but he only ended up holding the property for 3 years. He'd have been ahead of the game to have borrowed the money. That was not his goal up front. So what he ended up doing was changed by what happened in the marketplace. The second thing, and I think this is a very valuable lesson, is when you're doing business, if you do business with people who are in the market, who are fellow investors as opposed to civilians, they are in the market. So when the market changes, when something happens, they recognize it early on. Because I was very happy. Once I'd made that deal, there was no further activity involved, and I would have just sat there and gone to sleep. And surely I would have caught on as the value started plummeting towards 60 again. But he caught it earlier than I did. And as a result, we both did better than we otherwise would have done. Now, let's say that he had kept the property and we had not had the 2006 to 2012 years, but indeed properties had continued to go up as they promised to in the early 2000s. Then what would have happened is one day the property would have been $150,000. It would have been renting for $1,000 a month or $1,500 a month. And at that point, I could have exercised my option, paid the other $10,000 for half interest in the house, and then on a $30,000 investment, I would have had a cash flow in a managed house with him. So those are the kinds of opportunities that were born of sitting down with Steve and exploring the ways that he could raise the money he needed to make that deal. Value is so subjective, and most of you, I'm sure, have seen the benefits house that I use to remind me of the income and of the net worth and of the tax benefits and of the use that are the benefits that drive real estate investment. When you're sitting down with people, what use they're going to get from the property and what cost they're going to have to get it are going to be the key. I'll give you another quick example. This was not with an investor. This was with a civilian, a lady who I was referred to. And again, as many of you know who've heard me, almost everything I do comes as a result of repeat or referral business. I was called actually by a real estate broker to talk to a lady who was in her late 40s, and her husband had died suddenly in his late 40s. And when I went to meet with her, I went to meet with her with the broker who called me. I went to meet with her at her house. And, of course, when I sat down in this very nice house with a nice lady who had one daughter who was still in high school. And when I said, why would you sell a nice house like this? She explained that her husband had passed away and she could not afford to make the payments on the house. So she was going to have to find a less expensive place to live. When I proceeded to ask her what expenses she had that she had to cover, she wasn't very clear, but she did say, I can no longer afford the $1,000 a month payment on this house. And I said, well, what kind of a payment are you going to need? And she said, I'm going to have to get around a $700 payment. I'm going to have to move down. Well, when I talked to her a little bit about what was in her budget, it turned out that one of the things she did is she had a car loan that was costing her $350 a month, and that car loan was just a hair under $5,000 left as a balance on that car loan. And so what I did is I said, I will buy an option on your house for $5,000, which you can use to pay off the car loan. And having done that, you can then stay in the house because you'll reduce your expenses by $350 and you won't have to move. Your daughter won't have to change schools. You'll be able to stay here in the house. That was a godsend to her. Now, interestingly enough, that transaction was done in 2007. Our deal was that I could buy the property after 4 years and before seven. The purpose for that was to let her daughter finish school, stay with her before, and then when she went away to college, then they might sell the house. Well, it was a terrific deal. It was a terrific scheme. It was well constructed to fit her family, her situation. The problem was that the marketplace, which had a nice $150,000 house that I was optioning to buy at $135,000 4 years later, took that $150,000 house and turned it into an $80,000 house in the next 5 years. So while the structure I was surely very happy with, it would have looked a lot better had I done that exact same deal just 7 years earlier. So in any case, those are some of the options that I've done. Now, let's talk about a seller. We're talking to someone right now, and we've got a contract that I hope they'll accept. We wrote the contract with to the real estate broker, and it is supposed to be closed before the 31st of December. They've had a house on the market for over 2 years. They are asking $300,000 for the house. I offered to lease it with an option. Without the lease, there was no chance of them taking the deal because the house is sitting there vacant. The man has remarried. They've moved away from the house. And without the lease to take the responsibility of the house off their back, the taxes, the insurance, the electricity, the maintenance of the house off their back, then there's not any benefit there to them. And so we put, with that option that we negotiated or have attempted to negotiate, we added a lease to take the responsibility for the property off their back, not just get an option. Now, the great part of that was, by doing that, we can finance that equity for much less than we ever could have financed it with had we gone and borrowed money or used money to buy the property. We've offered two of those lease options this month. One of them is at $10,000 a year for a $224,000 house. The other one is at $1,500 a month for a $300,000 house. Well, when you take both of those numbers and you take the taxes and insurance and the expenses out of it, you will see that we're paying very little in the way of interest to control that property. But with both of them, because they were for sale properties, we had to add the lease to the option to make it attractive to someone who wanted to leave the house behind. Okay? Now, in my many, many years in real estate, I've done 120-plus options. Of all those options, which gave me the right to buy the property, I have exercised six of them. That brings to mind, well, what in the world happens if you don't exercise it? Well, most commonly, I assign it. A common assignment for me is a property I had an option on for a number of years, and then one of my friends had sold a property in California and wanted to buy a property in Florida. And he had the money sitting in Jack Shea's office as a 1031 exchange because he'd assigned the property to Jack, who'd sold it and was now looking for his replacement property. what we did is we assigned the contract to Jack Shea for the exchanger, and we got paid for the assignment of that contract, and that was one of the bigger ones. We made $85,000 on that one transaction for the assignment of that contract. They then closed and bought the property because we assigned the contract. Now, very similar situation. We had an option, and the person sold the property, and then they paid us off and terminated the option so that they could deliver clear title to the seller, to the buyer. And so we got paid to terminate or release the option as opposed to doing an assignment of the option. Now, in order to be able to do that, we needed some control and we needed people to recognize and find our option. In the ancient days of the 60s and the early 70s, I did a few options. One of them was a big option on a big piece of property in Florida when I was living in Boston. And I actually traded property into an option. And I got an option which was witnessed and which was notarized and which was recorded. And years later, as I drove by that property and looked, I noticed a building going up on my property. I discovered later that my option had been ignored. It had either been missed altogether or it had just been ignored, and they'd sold the property without contacting me whatsoever. Based upon that one experience and hearing stories of that kind of thing, that thing happening, and seeing some of my friends in the same situation, I began securing my options with a mortgage on the property. And now a mortgage or deed of trust has as its purpose the securing of a promise. And while typically we think of it as a mortgage which secures a note is a promise to pay, an option is a promise to sell if the buyer chooses to exercise. And so by putting that mortgage in the public record, recording it to secure my options, I have never since that day had one missed. I get a phone call at some point from a title person, from an attorney, saying, what do you want to take as a payoff on the mortgage? Then, of course, they actually sometimes read the document and see that it's not a note where there's a payoff. It's an option giving us the right to buy. Now, if I've got the right to buy and it's an investment property, my first response to that is generally, we invested in this option because we think this property is going to have a lot of capital appreciation, and we're looking to enjoy that appreciation, so we do not want to sell. We will be happy to allow your buyer to buy the property subject to our option, but we don't want to give up the right to sell, the right to profit in this property. Now, that generally has them tearing their hair out, but sometimes we have sold our options, thereby assigning them. Other times we have terminated them in order to enable those transactions to close. When it's my Roth IRA, my Roth IRA has made investments. That's clearly one of the entities that would like to invest in options. My Roth IRA is supposed to grow. That's why I have it, to grow and grow a good-sized retirement account for myself. And when I get a call because someone wants to buy or terminate, pay my IRA to terminate an option that's in my IRA, in those cases, I always say, no, just buy it subject to and let it stay there because I think this property is going to be worth more and more and more. Now, have I ever accepted one? Yes. Have I ever accepted the first offer? I don't think so. I've simply always been someone who liked real estate better than anything else, and real estate without work, which is one of the nice parts of the option, is one of my very favorites. And so when I leverage something by using an option, that's a very enjoyable deal for me. Now, let me talk to you about another option. And this was an option I gave on a property. I had a chance to buy two houses, and to make the numbers very, very easy, $100,000 apiece. And the owner would take $20,000 down and carry the mortgage for 30 years at 6% back in the day. So that meant I'd have a $180,000 mortgage on that property, which would cost me $1,100 a month. The mortgages were going to be $90,000 on each house, $540 each on each one of the two houses. Now, problem I had is I didn't have $20,000 to put down. So what I did is I sold a young man who had a very successful business an option to buy one of those two houses in 15 years at today's price for $20,000. So I sold him the right to buy one house for $100,000 with $20,000 down, which applied to the price, thereby making that tax-free money to me, or tax-deferred money to me. That $20,000 came to me. I used it as a down payment to buy those two houses. Now, we are 9 years into the 15 years. So there's six more years before he can take one of those houses away from me. But during that whole period, I had the upside in both houses. Then I had the downside in both houses. Now it appears as though there's a little bit of upside in both houses. But in the meantime, I've had all the tax benefits, all the thrill of management, and all the positive cash flow from both houses. When, after 15 years, he takes one house away from me, unless I negotiate a different deal with him, I will have used his money via the option to control two houses and given up the upside in one, but had all the cash flow from two, again, with the thrill of management while I held the properties. So that's another case of using an option to save some money, save some money, or in my case, provide some money because I did not have any. An option can be such a simple document, but also when you're dealing with people, you'll find that people have a favorite contract or a favorite attorney who's got his favorite word processing program, which has a contract in it, and they want to use it. Here in Florida, there's nothing they'd rather use than a Florida bar and Florida realtor contract, which is font size one, way too many pages, having little or nothing to do with my deal. When I get those kind of institutional contracts that aren't deal specific, but I want simply to option the property, I'll simply use a sole liquidated damages affidavit or additional comments as an addition to that contract to give me the right to not buy it and to minimize my cost, thereby converting it to an option for my purposes using a contingent contract and sole liquidated damages. And I think that's something that most anyone can do without getting more simple and easily understood options. Now, when you're using an option or any deal, when you're doing a deal with a fellow human being, you absolutely have to make sure that what you write down accurately reflects what you negotiated. Because one of the things that enables us to do business with people and then do repeat and referral business with those people is that we keep our word. We sit down with them. We care enough to ask them, why would you sell a nice house like this? We say to them, I'd like to help. We come across as someone who's caring, someone who's built a rapport with them, someone who will work to make them better off at the same time as we'll generate benefits for ourselves in the deal. And there's nothing worse than promising something in a negotiation and having the words of a standard contract betray what you said. And does it ever ruin your trust? And so from my perspective, when I'm doing an option or any other contract, you're going to find that it is one page, font size 10, 11, 12, double spaced. At worst, it's two pages, but it's simple and it's understandable. So both of the parties to that deal make the deal happily because we know we're getting what we promised. We're giving up less than we're getting in that specific transaction. We had a property that we had a mortgage with a due on sale clause on, and we had bought the property subject to that mortgage. We wanted to get that mortgage paid off. I found a young man who wanted to acquire a nice house, so I sold him a house I owned that appraised for $135,000. I sold it to him for $90,000. I took a $25,000 option from him as the down payment on my house. So he gave me an option on the house he did not yet own as a down payment to buy that house from me. So when that closed, he gave me $65,000 cash, much of which came from a new first mortgage, and a $25,000 option, giving me the right to buy the house at some time in the future when he was through with it for $90,000. Now, the $25,000 was a real $25,000, but it was not cash. By his giving me the $25,000 option down, I lost none of the upside in the house. I essentially had him as a caretaker in that house for a long period of time. And he got a new loan, which paid off my old loan. 2 years later, he finished building the new house that he was planning to build down here in Florida. And when it was finished, he had no need for my house. So at that point, I bought the house from him. I bought his house from him. It used to be mine. Now it's mine again. I bought it by giving him $25,000 down in the form of the option that I'd already been granted by him and paying him about $7,000 in cash for the rest of his equity and taking title subject to 6.25% mortgage institutional on the property. That is right now the only property I own with an institutional mortgage on it. But that transaction, like all transactions, was structured to help everyone out. He bought a house with very low payments. He became a caretaker in that house for me, and that worked just very, very, very well for both of us. That option protected me. When he closed on the property, he gave me an option on my property. He gave me $65,000 in cash. I gave him a deed to my property. I took the $65,000 in cash and paid off the $53,000 mortgage that I had on my property. So he got a free and clear property. But since he'd borrowed $60,000 from his lender, he then gave a first mortgage on his house to his lender to secure the $60,000. Then he gave a second mortgage to me to secure my option. Just to give you an example of how that paperwork worked. Now, another thing that I find, I own and trade through a lot of properties because I enjoy property, and I often trade, but I like to hold long term. And if I'm going to trade, I like to trade for other properties or trade and keep a string on my property so I can get it back. So one of the interesting things I get is every so often I'll get a call from someone and they'll say, you know, we'd really like to buy that property you have at such and such an address. And now we couldn't give you very much because they start negotiating right away. And I said, well, listen, don't start apologizing for your offer. That's really a bad way to negotiate. Just tell me what it is that will work for you, and I will see how and if I can make that work for me. So what happens is they typically will come in with an offer that's something like 50% of retail or perhaps a little less than that. And so they come in, and on that $100,000 house, let's say, they make me an offer of $50,000. When they do that, my typical response is to say, that's fine. I'll accept your contract contingent upon my having an option to buy my house back 7 years from now for $50,000. That's very interesting to watch how quiet it gets when I say that. I say, it's a very simple deal. I'll let you have my deed for 7 years, and at the end of the 7 years, I'll give you back your money, and you give me back my deed. So we can just swap. And when I've done that kind of a deal, it's always been face-to-face with a fellow human being. I have never yet made that counteroffer to a real estate agent and had them do anything except run away and never talk to me again. But many years ago, I had a lady who I traded a Gulf Front two-bedroom, two-bath townhouse. Nice water views. I traded her. I actually sold her that house, but I sold it to her as part of an exchange, where I traded into a real nice house she had, and then I sold her a house to live in, real cheap. I mean, real cheap. So $50,000, she was able to move into this house, and to balance the equities, I gave her a note that paid her $865 a month. So the $865 in income and the really inexpensive place on the water worked very nicely for her. But our deal was in 5 years, I got to give her back her $50,000, and she got to give me back my waterfront townhouse. Well, I was sure that when the 5 years ended, she would want to extend her time in that beautiful place on the water. And so it never occurred to me that I wouldn't get another bite and get a chance to acquire another house of hers and say, gee, you know, Fran, if you'll sell me this real nice house you got here in Seminole, then I'll extend the option for another 5 years. And lo and behold, the 5 years was almost up, and she called me, and her child, or her adult daughter, had developed cancer, and she had to move to help her daughter's husband take care of her daughter. And she called me and she said, you know, could you even close early so that I can complete my sale and move to Texas and take care of my daughter? Well, the only problem was I had to buy the place for $50,000, and I was only $50,000 light. And so I went and approached some other investors and said, gee, would you like to buy a two-bedroom, two-bath townhouse on the Gulf of Mexico for only $60,000? And so when I found one, it didn't take long because, again, that was probably a $170,000 townhouse back in the day. Somebody said, yes, I'll do it for $60,000. And I said, well, that's fine. You pay me $10,000. You pay Fran offer $50,000, she'll give you a deed to the townhouse, and you'll give me an option to buy the condo back, the townhouse back, in 5 more years for $60,000. And this guy said, well, look, you know, I can't buy a house and not make any profit on it. Houses have to go up. I have to make a profit. I said, well, you're buying it so far under market, and you're going to enjoy that waterfront property. isn't that enough? He said, no, it's not. I said, well, okay, tell me how much profit you need to make. He said, well, I need to make at least $5,000. I said, well, that's okay then. In that case, I don't have to exercise my option for 7 years. So I bought 2 years, 5 years from now, extending my time out to 7 years to pay $5,000 for the use of his $60,000 to close the deal. And those are the kinds of structures you can do. But while I used options again and again in all those examples I've given you, it all came down to people sitting down face to face and talking about and expressing what it was that was making them uncomfortable and how they could help one another. One of the other things that I do with options is not with regard to real estate, but I use a lot of paper in my deals. I trade paper. I give promises in the form of purchase money notes, seller financing to buy property on a very regular basis. And sometimes I have a chance to buy paper at a discount. Now, an example of that came up this past year when I had a chance to buy a $50,000 performing first mortgage for $30,000 cash. Terrific deal. One problem, I didn't have $30,000 cash. I did not want to take the chance and let that get away. So I went to one of my friends and I said, listen, I will assign my contract to buy this note to you and you can buy it for $30,000. But for doing that, I want an option to buy it from you for $30,000 sometime in the future. So you can get the 14% yield for the next 6 months, for the next year, for the next 2 years. But I want to control that discount because it will enable me to make a good deal. So by getting the option, I was able to keep control of an opportunity that came around when I didn't have the money to seize that opportunity. Now, using that option, I went out and started to offer to trade the $50,000 mortgage as a down payment to buy some real property, buy a house or some houses. And lo and behold, a couple months went by, and I finally thought I was closing in on a house when one of my friends started to complain about a $100,000 note that he had that was not performing. It was not secured, and the investor who'd made the promise was struggling. He was struggling like so many of the people here because his equities had evaporated in this market. Well, I knew the guy who was not able to pay the $100,000 note, and I knew that he would pay if he were given a means to pay. So I traded the $50,000 note that I didn't have, but I had an option to buy, for the $100,000 note. The $100,000 note that was unsecured. So I had to give $30,000 to Joe to get Joe to deliver the $100,000 note to Jack. I'm sorry, the $50,000 note to Jack, so Jack would deliver the $100,000 note to me. Now I had to go to the man who could not pay the $100,000 note in cash and say, listen, if you can pay me, I'll take payment in $30,000 in cash and $70,000 in equities in good houses you have. And so, because I had the option on the $50,000 note, I was able to acquire $100,000 note that the man couldn't pay in cash, but that he could pay with $30,000 cash and property. And I like property better than I like cash. So all those deals are not just a simple option. Once I got the option, I stay in the game and look for opportunities to use the option. But many, many times my options to buy paper have been very valuable options and easy to get, because if you're out in the marketplace, you will find opportunities all the time that are good deals for someone. And if you'll just simply allow someone else to take them, with the caveat that you've got an option to take it away from them sometime in the future, and it's still a good deal for them, it's not hard to get that kind of an option. And optioning paper that way is a terrific, terrific way to do business. My friend Andy Phillips, who many of you guys know, is a great hard money guy. One of his favorite things when he's giving a note is to say to people, I want the option. I'll give you the option to call me and say, I want 6 months of payments in advance. But if you do that, I want you to give me credit for 8 months of payments. And so then if you ever need cash for anything in a lump sum, call me up and I'll show up with the money. And what's in it for me is I get credit for eight and I only have to pay you six, but you get the ability, the right to come up and get the cash you need to generate. And then when people say, yes, I'd love to have that right, Andy turns right around and says, well, since I've given you the option to call on me for the money, I'd like you to give me the option that when I've got some extra money, I can pay you 8 months by paying six in advance. And so by making that option for option exchange, he's able to essentially definance his properties and minimize his costs and yet generate lump sums of cash to people who do business with him carrying paper. That's an excellent, excellent model of a way to use non-real estate options to enhance the deals you make. So there's a few things. I traded a van for an option last year. I trade notes and mortgages, which give people income, for options on a relatively regular basis. I have in my IRA options that I've traded for mortgages, and I've had mortgages inside my IRA, which give me a nice yield and a good income. But if I can trade them for growth, I will give up the mortgage in return for the growth. Right now, my Roth IRA is holding a $40,000 first mortgage. It's a great first mortgage with a good young man as a payor, probably 55% loan to value. Nice rental house, great kid. Am I happy getting 8%, having him pay like clockwork, knowing when he's taking care of the collateral? I'm very happy. But when I show up at the exchange meeting on Thursday, one of the first things I'm going to mention is my IRA has a $40,000 note. It's 3 years before it's due, but it pays interest every month, and it's very secure with a great payor. And if I could trade that for growth, I'll do it. So if I can trade that $40,000 mortgage and give up the cash flow to control one or two or three nice properties, or to provide that income to some young investor who's estate building for a part interest in some of his houses, that's an exchange I'm very apt to make. Because the benefits I want mesh so well with the benefits he wants. Now, when I started this, I talked about you got to be wary of being technique driven. You have to make sure you structure the transaction so that the benefits transfer and so that both parties or all parties are happier. That's what makes a winning transaction. A great example of that is I bought a house up on 102nd Avenue. Well, must be 15 years ago. But I just knew in going in to sit down with this young couple that I was going to structure a wraparound mortgage as the way that I was going to buy this house from them so they could move out of town and leave the house behind. I sat down at the kitchen table with the couple who owned the house, and her dad stayed in the living room with their three children, watching the kids while the parents spoke with me. As we were talking about the deal, and I was moving slowly but surely toward making my transaction with them as a wraparound mortgage and the deed transfer. Suddenly the father walks in to the kitchen and says, "Now, excuse me, I just couldn't help but overhear. And what you guys are talking about sounds just like a contract for deed. When your mom and I lived in Michigan, we did two contracts for deeds, and they worked wonderfully." Well, as soon as the father endorsed a contract for deed, I threw away all my ideas of the wraparound mortgage, wrote it as a contract, because with the father's endorsement, why should I keep trying to battle for something when I already had this gentleman standing there doing battle for me to stand up and say, this is a way this could be done. And so don't be proud of, gee, I used an option, or gee, I used a lease option. Be proud of the benefits that you can construct for other people and those that you can construct for yourself. When I profit by my options, I profit by assigning them, by terminating them, by exercising them, and by extending them. The deal I did with a lady who lost her husband, that deal ran out last year. The 5 years were up, and the house isn't close to worth what my option strike price was. So I went back to her and said, could you use some more money? You know, the market's gone down. I'd like to stay in this deal with you for a longer period of time. And she had a daughter who's now in college. And so I was able to pay her to extend the option. So though the market turned on me, and I surely have lost some of the time, just ran out, I've been able to successfully extend two of them in the last 12 months. And that extension with the time, hopefully will buy me enough time to win. Many years ago, I was in a class with Jack Miller, and Jack was saying, you know, Pete typically does exchanges of options. And Jack said, you know, usually Pete's looking to exchange up into a bigger option. And that really wasn't accurate. When I'm negotiating, what I'm normally looking for is bigger and more control would surely be better. But what I'm looking for is more time. The more time I can buy, the more safety I have that something will happen, giving me an opportunity to win. The option, using leverage without any debt and with minimal management. You can't say no management because you really do need to kind of oversee it a little bit. Has been a tool that I've used over and over again, and used it even out of state, which is a place I'm not comfortable going, but just having an option works very nicely. I made a loan recently where the condition of the loan was that I had to have an option for 25% of the upside in the house. And so as consideration for my making the loan, I got 6% interest and cash flow, and I got the upside in the form of the option on that property that I made a loan on. Now, could I get an option on a different property? Absolutely. Now that I have both the option and the loan and the note and the mortgage, I'm free to trade the note and mortgage to buy even more real estate and keep the option. Or I'm free to trade the option for a property to give me more cash flow. But it's just one more tool, but it's an extraordinary tool, and one that can be used, like any of them, to do good things for you and to do good things for others. And all you people have seen me use the T-bar in the class, right? Say, here's your present position. Here's your potential position. My goal is to construct a potential position for people where they're happier being than they would be staying where they are. Because people do business because they like what they're getting more than they like what they're giving up. Now, I apologize for talking through the entire hour without ever stopping to take a question, but thank you guys all very much.
It was good. Is it okay if we take a few questions, Peter?
Oh, yeah, I love the questions. That's the best part.
Okay, listen, if anybody has a question, you need to press star 2 on your phone so I can unmute your line. Or if you prefer, you can send an email to Jackie, J-A-C-K-I-E, at cashflowdepot.com, and I'll be glad to ask the question for you. And I want to start out with a question of my own, Peter. First of all, thank you for so many great examples of some really creative option strategies. In any kind of a technique or strategy, there's not just one right way. There's so many different ways to build together, and you've given us a lot of different examples. You know, one of the things that I've noticed about you in the years that I've known you, it seems like just about for most investors, when they buy something, they think, okay, I've got it, I'm going to own it forever, my kids are going to inherit it, my grandkids are going to inherit it, and that's it. But you're a little different because every single asset that you have is currency, basically. It's something that you can use to go get something else that you might want a little bit better, or that you can use to, to put other deals together. And it's a paradigm shift that so many people just don't have, to think of the things that they own, whether it's the money, the knowledge, the rental property, you know, the paperwork to create an option, any of those things, that's currency that you can use to go out and continue to build your estate and build wealth.
That's very, very, very right. That's exactly on point. And, for example, as you know, one of the things that I developed a reputation in was in using so much paper in my deals over the years. And investing in paper, given the inflation that you face and that we see, is always a questionable activity. Well, I don't mind accepting paper in a deal because the paper is a terrific currency. The $40,000 note I talked about earlier, I'm getting 8%, a great return, a cash flow that comes in every month. Am I happy seeing an extra $268 every month? Of course I am. But someplace on the line, I'll be able to trade that paper into property, or trade it for an option to control upside. And that allows me to protect myself against inflation. And so the paper is not the illiquid thing it seemed to be. It's indeed a currency. And every house, the lease, the management, the rent of a house, the options I have on houses, all of those things are currencies. And it's the way that you're able to make a deal is by giving up something you value less for something that you value more, or you anticipate will do good things, better things for you. And, of course, it's always in the anticipation. Yeah.
Right. But when you just acquire things and you hang on to them and you're not always keeping your antenna up for other opportunities, then that's where inflation can hurt you, or the changes in the economy can hurt you. But you've got to really pay attention to what's going on in the market and what opportunities are out there that maybe something that you own could be used as a down payment or used to acquire something that would put you in a better position.
Yeah, and I very, very much am attuned to that. But remember, I'm the guy, I have no life. This is all I do. It's either real estate and investing or nothing. It's not like I have a broad bunch of interests. I have one interest, and I focus on it very, very much.
Yes, I know. I know that very well.
Okay. All right. Yep. I just want to make sure you're paying attention. That's all.
Yep. By the way, if anybody has a question, all you need to do is press star 2, and I'll be glad to unmute your line. We've got one from Jerry here in Austin, Texas. Just go ahead, Jerry.
Hi, Jackie and Peter. Thank you for having this webinar. I hate to beat a dead horse, but since the Dodd-Frank directly talks about notes and so forth, is there any skill levels that you would apply to the situation, or you're not concerned about it?
I'm definitely not concerned with Dodd-Frank any more than any other way that the government's going to interfere. I enjoy the fact that it'll drive competition away because people get so frustrated with the government messing things up. But the big key, I think, from my perspective is I don't deal with consumers. Now, that's not just with mortgages and notes like Dodd-Frank would seem try to control, but I deal with investors and capitalists, and Dodd-Frank and the SAFE Act are allegedly a consumer protection law. So I simply do not deal with consumers who are buying property for their family to use.
That's a very good point. Thank you.
All right.
Hey, we've got a question from Hank. Go ahead, Hank.
Hey, Peter. Hank Balter. You were mentioning that you're looking to always buy time into the future. What's your thought on that? I kind of missed the reason for doing that. I think it had something to do with your decision-making process on what to do with a property.
I was talking about the options, Hank, when I said Jack said at one of the seminars that I was always exchanging, and like with 1031 exchanging, where typically you were looking to exchange up into ever larger, ever grander properties, with my options, I'm looking to exchange an option or sell an option and replace it with a different option or trade for options that are ever longer, because the more time you have, the more time you have for something to happen in the lives of the parties to the deal and in the marketplace to create more opportunities for yourself. So if I've got a short-term option that's going to expire in February next year, and I could trade that option for an option on another property that same guy had that was 5 years long, 5 years away, I'd rather have the 5 years. I'd rather have that bigger window in which to await and watch for and structure an opportunity rather than to be under pressure to get something done in 90 days. So longer is safer to me. Now, the other thing is realize I'm 66 and I've got four kids and two grandkids, and I'm hoping that one day some of them will be happy they're related to me. So pushing some equities off into the future is one of the things that I can do for the family and for the people who I love, without getting myself too wrapped around my axle managing or mismanaging those assets.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Okay. Anytime, Hank.
Thank you.
You know, we had another question that was emailed in, Peter, and it's written kind of long, so I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. It appears from your conference call that you're primarily looking for option situations where the owner of the house is going to stay there. Is that the main thing that you're looking for?
No, it's definitely not the main thing. I'm not looking for options. I am looking for opportunities to help people with uncomfortable circumstances. When people want to stay in a house, either stay in one they already have or acquire one to stay in, that should suggest that if you can acquire an option on that house, that will work for them. If I put up half of the down payment for someone to buy a house, and instead of them giving me payments on that money as if it were a loan or as a loan, they give me half or all of the upside. They've paid for a house with growth rather than with cash flow, which means maybe they can afford a house they wouldn't otherwise have found. Now, the next example that I talked about earlier was the people who have the house down here that's been on the market for 2 years. The last thing they want to do is use it. He's already remarried, moved away from the house. So with that, I offered them a lease and an option. The option enabled me to control the house in terms of its price, but the lease took the burdens of management, maintenance, taxes, insurance off his back. And without my adding that lease, I couldn't have made a deal with him, because he has no desire, no intention to ever set foot in that house again. So I'm always watching. I'm very attuned to what makes people comfortable and uncomfortable. Many of you guys have heard me tell a story about my son Jay making a great deal on a house down in Northeast St. Pete. And when I said to Jay, you know, how did you find that opportunity? He said, well, Dad, I was driving down 22nd Avenue, and I saw this lady kicking a realtor sign. Well, that's a sign of an uncomfortable circumstance. He stopped and talked to her, and we did a lease option on a house that had been in multiple listing that the broker had been unable to sell. But she was out of that house. She'd already moved into her new house. An option would not have worked for her. A lease option worked very nicely.
Okay, I've got one more question, but before I go to that question, I want to, I've sent out some emails about it, but I want to make sure everyone's aware that Peter is teaching a seminar called Creative Option Strategies, where he's going to go into a lot more detail about finding these opportunities and structuring them. The workshop is March 8th and 9th in Costa Mesa, California. You can see details about it if you go to Cashflow Depot and .com and click on the where the store is. There's a drop down, just click on events and you'll see a lot of information about some of the different things that he's going to cover and the hotel where it's going to be and all the information. So once again, that's Creative Option Strategies on March 8th and 9th in Costa Mesa, California, and I'm going to be there. It'll be out in California and I don't know how long. Well, I've been back in the United States in over 2 years, so I'm coming back to the United States to go to your seminar.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that one. I'm really, really looking forward to that class.
I'm looking forward to hearing some more of these creative deals because, you know, whenever we hear you talk, Peter, our creative juices just start flowing, and you start seeing whenever you talk to sellers and maybe couldn't put a deal together the way you were wanting to, that all of a sudden in the back of your mind say, I remember Peter talking about that deal he did and, you know, and how you did it. And then it just makes you think, wow, that scenario would work perfectly in this situation. So it really trains your brain to be creative when we listen to you, and we need that.
Yeah, well, I do think that understanding if you can't do it one way, you can do it another is something you just have to get. You have to know that in your soul. You have to know that there is another way to do this. And if you quit, it's your fault. But at the class, whenever I get a chance to talk to people in person, I have a workbook where they see some of the language and what that I've used. And it really is person-to-person transaction making. And I think that the paper that goes behind all those different examples that I just talked about and a lot of other ones is very, very important because many of the people are so used to going and looking for a form or a document in a word processor rather than paying attention to the English language and the things they learned in the eighth grade and just writing it down in simple English so everybody understands what's going on. And I work hard at doing that kind of paperwork.
Right. I'm just going to do this one other question that came in through email, and then we'll call it a night. I know you've been talking a lot, and I sure appreciate all the information you shared with everyone. The other question, I'm sure it's one that comes up all the time, is where is the best place to find real estate opportunities, whether it's an option or not an option? Just where's the best place to find opportunities?
Out in the streets. What I do and even still do to some extent, but did when I started as a real estate agent, was I go into the streets and ask people to help me. You have to recruit allies at all times. When I've got a neighborhood that I like, I go door to door, and if I'm one of those people who doesn't like going door to door, I go for a walk in the neighborhood, take a nice little dog, not a Rottweiler, take a baby in a carriage or something to break the ice and just say to people, hi, my name is Pete Fortunato. I'm looking for a house in this neighborhood. How long have you lived here? And when you're done, say, will you please call me or have your neighbors call me? And if you'll do that, you will begin to get the repeat and referral calls that will help you do business. The other point that I always make in acquisition, my acquisition class, that I hope everybody gets is every deal you close is a seed that should grow a vine full of more deals. It just means that when you've made a deal, it's been a good one, and you've stayed in contact with the people. You said it earlier how people do a deal, and then just a lifetime later, they look back and say, what a great deal. rather than staying connected to those people and asking them for a repeat and referral. You know, I always talk about John Pochak, who I did that deal with back in 1969. I bought a little triplex from him, and when he passed away in 2000, we had done 27 transactions together. I've done 4 with his daughter and son-in-law. He referred innumerable people to me. Those all started with one little triplex. And it's so important for people to understand, get out in the streets, visit with people, talk to them of what you're trying to do, and ask for help.
Right. And always be looking for that deal after the deal.
Yeah. Well, and always you say, you know, why would you sell a nice house like this? Why would you give this up? Because there's a story there, and that story is important. That's what is inspiring them or could inspire them to make a deal with you.
You're exactly right. Pierre, this was just a great coaching call. Thank you so much for sharing so much information in a short period of time. You really pack a lot into an hour. I'm very impressed. I know everybody else is on the call, and I look forward to seeing you in Costa Mesa in March, and I know that a lot of people on the call are going to be there, too, and we just can't wait to learn more from you.
Thank you very much.
Costa Mesa. Thanks, Peter. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
The moderator has left the conference.